goes.
Okay.
Okay,
sorry.
Enjoy
the list. Yeah, he does. He sits up. No, he wanted to make sure that I remembered to turn it on. It's the business end of a mountain goat, a very olfactory animal, a mountain goat. You can barely see because of the light here. You can barely see the turbinates, the cartilaginous bony surface on which the epithelium is arranged, or the epithelial cells are arranged, which is in a relatively simple, actually, in this animal, in a rat. It's quite a torturous chamber that you find the odorants crawling around in. The first thing I'm going to talk to you about is presynaptic inhibition of primary sensory afferents. This is shockingly missing from that chapter, actually. There's been, I think, a reasonable amount of work in the last couple of years on presynaptic inhibition. The reason I wanted to choose this one as something to talk about to you, besides it being an interesting story, is that it's something that isn't necessarily often built into models yet. At least when I cursorily read them and understand circuit models, I don't see regulation of the release of transmitter by presynaptic terminals as sort of a first order thing that people are thinking about. Yet, as someone who studies synaptic physiology, my problem is actually choosing which presynaptic terminal to study and which process to look at, because presynaptic regulation of transmitter release is all over the brain. It's a ubiquitous phenomenon that really means that you cannot predict a priori from a spike train what is going to be the output of any neuron. I mean, I really have to emphasize that. Single unit recording of a firing rate of a neuron is, in the absence of knowledge about whether or not there's regulation of the presynaptic terminal release, is almost useless information. You cannot develop the transfer function unless you have some more information about the output of that neuron, both because there are processes that I'll talk about, facilitation and depression, but also because there are active processes to regulate the output of synapses.
Can you explain how it differs from synaptic depression?
I will. Okay. That's what I'm going to do first. So then I'd like to talk about long-lasting, and I've got that in quotes, short-term facilitation, using the accessory olfactory bulb as the example. This will be a really short story, just to make a point about the utility of what we call short-term facilitation, which is to say an activity-dependent upregulation of release. So when a neuron starts firing a few action potentials one after another, you find that sometime if you stop stimulating and then wait a little period of time and then stimulate again, that you get a lot more transmitter, or you'll get more transmitter out of that terminal. It's the opposite of what you think of as depression, is that what you were mentioning, the depression. This is ideally suited, as you can imagine, very quickly to act as an integrator. It basically adds up the action potentials, keeps track of their rate and number over some period of time, and this information about the previous history is encoded in the amount of transmitter that's released at some time subsequent. The example I want to choose is one where this facilitation is particularly long-lasting, and as a result, it's very well set up. The system is extremely well set up to deal with very sparse inputs, very low rates of firing of the input to this part of the brain can still lead to activity over, if you give it enough time to build up. And I would argue that this is very useful for detecting if you have to detect a signal, but not necessarily so useful if you're trying to discriminate between many signals, but particularly useful if you're trying to detect something at low levels. Oops. You'll probably fall asleep by then. But calcium-activated non-specific currents, I mentioned them when I was talking to when Jeff was here. We've invested a lot of effort in looking at these currents in granule cells. The properties of them, they're quite ubiquitous. You find them in the hippocampus. We're finding them all over the in vertebrate brain. These are very useful boost currents. They They make the neuron more excitable. They depolarize the neuron further. The reason that I think computationally, and I use that term loosely, computationally they're useful is that by being dependent upon calcium and influx, and given that calcium influx has particular voltage dependencies to it, that is, you can arrange it so that the calcium influx only happens when you get sufficient depolarization or when specific types of neurotransmitter receptors are activated, these currents can be easily used to amplify only one kind of synaptic input and not the other kind of synaptic input. And I use strong versus weak, and hopefully we'll have time to just walk through that. None of these concepts, incidentally, are deep or difficult. You can probably relax your brain this morning. And then I really would like to talk about number four. So if it's looking like everyone's wanting to get out of here, we'll skip. Maybe we'll end up skipping three to get to four, because I think four is a nice little take-home message. It helps to bring together some of the I wouldn't say confusion, but the sense that well, what good is lateral inhibition for, and why would you have lateral inhibition and feedback inhibition in granule cells onto those mitral cells that Jeff was talking about, if you know all it's going to do is just shut down the mitral cell that's being active and shut down all its neighbors? How can you use this phenomenon effectively? As it turns out, it looks like the way in which one is able to use it in an interesting way comes out of some interesting chemistry that happens within the spine, so that you can select to, as I'll give you the take-home message, you can turn down the feedback inhibition selectively, leaving the lateral inhibition intact. And that's very useful, because then the mitral cell doesn't turn itself off, but it can turn its neighbors off, but not turn itself off. If the situation so requires. This was the cartoon sketch of the bulb to remind you what the elements are. Remember, there's these primary afferents that are coming in from the nose into glomeruli. The glomeruli are consisting of these the tufts, the apical, distalapical tufts of the mitral cells, which is the principal neuron of the bulb. Remember, the mitral cell is the only output of the bulb. It's relatively, you look at it and at first blush it seems like a very, very simple part of the brain, one of which you can't imagine there being, or you could imagine there wasn't really very much processing going on. It was just a relay. The inputs come into the mitral tufts, the mitral cell goes out to the cortex, and then there's some interneurons that do a little bit of inhibition. But I hope to leave you with the impression that it actually has an enormous capability to regulate that flow of information. So I'm going to concentrate first on this section up here, the glomerular layer. A neuron that hasn't been mentioned much is this periglomerular cell. Okay, so there are actually two places in which one has local and lateral inhibition in the bulb. One you've heard about from Jeff down here with the granule cells, and that's received a lot of attention, largely I think because it's more accessible than this part up here, the periglomerular region. These are the glomerular, in the glomerular layer. These periglomerular cells are really tiny, and they're in the order of 8 microns in diameter. That creates severe technical difficulties for recording, almost impossible to record with sharp electrodes. Really hard. they don't in the mammal. This is a pretty reasonable picture for a mammal, in as much as a periglomerular cell will sit either with its cell body in the glomerular capsule. And the glomerulus, remember, is a glial encased collection of these mitral cell dendrites, the presynaptic afferents, and then the dendrites of periglomerular cells. They'll sit either just inside or just outside that glomerular capsule. They'll have a dendrite that projects up into a portion of the glomerulus, where it makes dendrodendritic contacts where it makes the periglomerular cell makes a dendritic contact with the dendrite of a mitral cell. It the mitral cell also makes a dendritic contact with the paraglomerular cell. Once again, this theme of reciprocal dendrodendritic connections between excitatory mitral cells and inhibitory interneurons is reiterated in the glomerular layer, just as it is down in the granule cell layer. The paraglomerular cells, this is a very simplified cartoon. There's actually at least two sort of broad connectivity classes of paraglomerular cells that I've collapsed into one here. Some of the paraglomerular cells receive most or all of their inputs from the olfactory nerve fibers themselves. So they get a drive straight from the olfactory nerve. It appears that another sort of broad group of paraglomerular cells get their primary input from the mitral cell dendrite and not from the olfactory nerve. And we see that actually we can see a hint of that when immunocytochemistry is done. You find that there are sort of two populations of paraglomerulars, at least in terms of where they send their dendrites. There's the population that seems to get its input from the olfactory nerve is located somewhat more superficially to this other population that's a little bit a little deeper in the bulb, and they're differentiated based on the neurotransmitters that they express. There's quite a variety of neurotransmitters that are expressed by paraglomerular cells, mainly GABA, which you tend to know of as an inhibitory element, and dopamine, which in this case also turns out to be inhibitory, but in its function. But luteinizing hormone, releasing hormone, substance P and cephalins, there's an awful richness of neurotransmitters that are expressed by these interneurons, usually more than one at a time. They're co-localizing GABA with something else, so they're releasing more than one transmitter at a time. So it creates an extreme complexity, and we're really just beginning to unravel these paraglomerular cells, because I say they say they've been difficult to work with. These numbers are just there for your amusement, as much as anything, to give you a sense of the scale of what we're talking about in the olfactory bulb. These are from the rat. The rabbit has about 50 million receptors that converge on about 2,000 glomeruli. The rat has around 20 million, ending up with about 12,000, so that you have about 12,000 afferent fibers going into each glomerulus. So there's a lot of convergence there. Somewhere in that glomerulus, you're going to find between 20 to 50 what we call mitral cells or tufted cells. There are actually at least three classes of mitral cells that we, you know, for the sake of simplicity here and keeping you from getting too confused, we won't go into gory details. But based on their where they send their secondary dendrites, whether or not their axon has collaterals within the bulb or not, we can see several classes of mitral cells. But the two broad descriptions that one finds presented are tufted or displaced mitral cells, and then the regular mitral cell. And this just refers to the fact that there's this cell body layer down deep that we refer to as the mitral cell body layer. And that's where, you know, it's a relatively nice tight layer that you think of like in layer 5 or something like that, or even say more better would be think of like CA1 in hippocampus. And then just outside that, in the boundaries of the EPL, the external plexiform layer, where the interaction, where most of the connections between granule cells and mitral cells are taking place, you find some mitral cells, some of which are actually quite displaced, up quite close to the.
Each mitral cell gets its input only from one glomerulus.
But now, in a mammal, each mitral cell sends one apical dendrite up to one glomerulus. In turtles, this is actually important. There's actually an evolutionary progression. I'm going to talk about frogs. Most of this talk is actually going to be on data collected in frogs, for reasons that I hope become obvious. But the reason that that's actually legitimate is the basic design of the olfactory bulb. You can see remarkable conservation from fish all the way up to us. But one place where where there has been a perhaps significant change in functionality, is that whereas there's one, in all mammals, pretty much all mammals, you have only one apical dendrite going up to a glomerulus. In a turtle, you'll have two very commonly. So that you'd have another one going over to another glomerulus, coming somewhere off, say, off the secondary dendrite. In frog, it's not uncommon to see three. Two is very common. One alone is actually rather uncommon. But one and two are two is quite common, and more is not exceptional. So a few would be the way I would say in frog. And then in fish, it's quite, you have even more. You have quite a proliferation of mitral cell apical dendrites. Well, the argument is you're getting more precise. In as much as you're saying that you're only going to pay attention to one receptor type, but it's not clear it's not clear really what the functional loss is. No one has ever taken a turtle and tested it in a way to see how well could it discriminate particular odors relative to how well a rat could discriminate particular odors. But the naive assumption, or the first assumption, would be that yes, somehow this is focusing the mitral cells and reducing their increasing their fidelity for a particular odor. But it's not that difficult to imagine, given all of the interconnections that are going on up here, that it doesn't have other tricks to compensate. And if we get to it, if I show you the anatomy of the periglomerular cells in a frog, they actually differ from a mammal in that they also go to multiple glomeruli. And each of the different tufts that they have can act independently. So it has a different meshwork out there that may be able to retune the system back up. You're getting almost into religion or philosophy, but it is an observation. So I want to talk about this part here to begin with, and discuss some of the regulation then that's going on. I always forget going on up here in this so-called glomerular triad, where you have an input, an output, and a modulator of the output, a modulator of the input. We know that there are, on the mitral tuft, it's been known for quite a while, that there are these GABAergic ionotropic receptors. And we're all familiar with the difference between an ionotropic and a metabotropic receptor, because I'm going to use those terms quite often. What I mean by an ionotropic receptor, quite simply, is one that when the transmitter binds to it, it's going to open up and pass an ion. A metabotropic is going to activate a second messenger system of some sort. So in this example, the dopaminergic receptor will act via some G protein to regulate something else within the mitral cell. It can either regulate voltage gated channels, or it could even regulate the transmitter release process, for example, and cut down the release probability. You may not if it acts on, in this instance, since this mitral dendrite is actually a presynaptic terminal, if the effect of the metabotropic receptor was to go and interfere with transmitter release or turn up transmitter release by interacting with the release machinery, then no, you wouldn't see any effect of that from a voltage point of view. If instead, though, the receptor was coupled to a potassium channel and opened a potassium channel, then you might see a voltage effect associated with it. It just depends whether it's coupled to another ion receptor or not. Ion channel, or whether it's coupled to something else within the cell. So it's pretty very well established that the olfactory nerve releases glutamate. There's some other weird peptides. There's another peptide in there called carnosine that doesn't seem to have anything to do with anything electrophysiological, and another protein that's ubiquitously found called olfactory marker protein, found in all vertebrate presynaptic terminals. And it doesn't seem to have anything to do with something electrophysiological. Probably, I think the feeling, there's a new school of thought that these have something, though, to do with the redirection of these afferents and their reconnection during development, because as you know, these receptor cells turn over every 30 days or so in you and I, a little faster in some of the smaller animals. So these receptor cells are always dying, their axons are disappearing, new ones are being born from the epithelium underneath, and then those new ones have to send an axon out and find the appropriate glomerulus. It's one of the cooler parts of cell biology of the bulb, is that there's this constant flux of connections. And since, as Jeff mentioned, there's this tendency for receptor cells that have decided to express one particular surface protein receptor molecule to converge onto the same glomerulus. Once a new cell is born, it has to find that glomerulus again. So it has to migrate out from the nose and wander through the bulb and find its place. And that's what's illustrated up here again, just to hammer that point home, is that you have this parceling out of the presynaptic receptors, presynaptic afferents, so that there's a tendency for them to converge onto one or a couple glomeruli. Jeff didn't want to complicate the story, but the prettiest examples are just one glomerulus. It's where all of the receptors seem to converge to one, but in actual fact there are several instances as they walk through this family of about 1,000 receptor genes where you find a couple of glomeruli are actually the site of target for those receptors. But it's the main point is it's a very small number, which sets the field. Now, I think that's what I wanted to do. So I just thought you could barely see it in here because it's so bright, but I thought you might be like to see what these terminals actually look like inside a glomerulus. Back. So if I have any luck, I don't have any luck, escape. There we go. So these are presynaptic terminals where I've put a dextran conjugate dye into the nose. Managed to get the receptor cells in the nose to pick it up, and then they transport it out from the nose into the olfactory bulb. And these little blobs that you're seeing here, things like those are actually the presynaptic terminals within the olfactory bulb. They're actually quite large, and each of these afferents makes about five or six little boutons as it traverses through a portion of the glomerulus. So
this is a trace of just one receptor.
This is actually this is an image, of at one plane, at one sort of focal plane, of presynaptic terminals from one or a couple of axons.
There's an axon.
Was the dye specific to a certain chemical?
No.
It's multiple glomeruli because...
No, it's one glomeruli. I filmed many, many glomeruli, and then I went with my camera and I honed in on one glomerulus. Okay? So presumably, these are all terminals from neurons that are expressing a single receptor. Okay? Because they're all in this glomerulus. Coming from all over within the epithelium, and this is just to give you a sense of how these axons. This is only a fraction of them as well. I went around and found a glomerulus where I hadn't filled very many of the cells going into it, because if you fill them all, it's just a ball of thousands and thousands of terminals. You really can't see anything except terminals everywhere. It's a very compact mess, and that's something that is actually probably very important in functioning of the mitral cell. The glomerulus is a very compact space. It's covered in a glial sheath, and there are glia that interdigitate amongst it to create a closed space. And then it's just packed with these mitral cell dendrites. It's packed with the dendrites of paraglomerular cells, and then packed with terminals. There's not a lot of extra space. So in fact, things that get released by terminals or say potassium that comes out of dendrites when they're active, glutamate that comes out of dendrites when it's being released, can accumulate inside this space and begin to have action at a distance, which is actually... So in this case, this is in a frog, so this is about 30 microns. And this is another difference as we move up through the evolutionary chain. Is that in a mouse you'll have about 50 to say 100 micron diameter structures that are the glomerulus. In a rabbit, they're 100 and even 200, quite large. As you move down, when you get to the fish, they're on the order of around 10 or 20 microns in diameter. And the amphibia are a little bit bigger, and the turtles are a little bit bigger. And so this is a relatively large, this is one of the larger glomeruli in the frog. This was done in a frog at about 30 microns across. About that. Anyway, so these are just multiple planes as well, walking through that Oops, that's not what I should have done. I know how to get back to where I want to be. Actually, I figured it out. That's just collapsing them all into one. But you really can't see it terribly well. So I'm going to talk about the frog because we use frogs for reasons that will become apparent right here. That bantering, the friendly bantering that was going on between Jeff and I, there was, and between you and Jeff as well, was this problem of well, if you're studying a slice that's been disconnected from the nose, not only have you chopped the network up in that you've only taken a slice of what is actually a very distributed network, and these microcells go over half a millimeter or a millimeter, they spread out, so it's difficult to retain any of the extended aspects of the bulb when you do slices, but also you lose the opportunity to stimulate with an odorant, which, as I'll argue here, means that you have trouble delivering a stimulus into this network that has spatial and temporal patterns that approximate even remotely what it normally sees. What I mean by that is that if you've got a slice, whether it's a slice of hippocampus or whatever, all you can do to activate the network is put a wire on an afferent set of fibers, some incoming fibers, deliver an electrical stimulus, fire an input, and then watch what happens in the rest of the network. The problem here is that all of these afferents are going to go off at the same time, which means that you have a synchronous input, usually very strong, which will excite the network. And inevitably, what you see immediately thereafter is feedback inhibition. It's the psychophysical equivalent of the strobe light experiment to study vision. So you can learn a little bit about who's connected to whom, but if there's anything anything about the way the network functions that actually uses the fact that normally inputs come into different places within the within the network, depending upon whether it's a particular odor or not, or if the inputs are spread out in time in any sense, as they are certainly with odors, then you run a risk, and as it turns out you do, lose the ability to watch the network process the information in the way that its synapses are designed to process. Okay. So I was disturbed by this a few years back, interested in studying olfaction, but disturbed by the fact that I knew that the normal mode of behavior of an olfactory circuit when an odor came on was for it to break into an oscillatory pattern of activity, wherein in a mammal it's very common for there to be sort of a 40 hertz or so oscillation within each breathing cycle. That's you and I, same thing. You saw those field recordings that Jeff showed you at the end of his talk, where there's just this going on with the application of the odor. So we knew they oscillated, and I knew you couldn't get oscillations out of a slice. You can put bicuculin on it and disinhibit it, and maybe get it to go kind of epileptic. It can be something that looks like oscillations, but they're actually, the frequency's all wrong. So I decided to develop a prep where I could keep a brain alive outside of an animal, but have an epithelium, a nasal epithelium attached to it that I could deliver the odors to, so that I have the opportunity to drive the network with something closer to what it's normally driven with. I mean, I still, of course, have the opportunity to stimulate it electrically, and I do all that all the time. So this is was a nose brain preparation. Okay, there are a number of reasons not to leave it in the animal. I would love to leave it in the animal. This is actually, it turns out, a lot easier to get by the Animal Care Committee than anything involving in vivo work. Secondly, it's not anesthetized. Anytime I want to work in vivo, and I do, I have to anesthetize the animal. Which means I have to shut down a chunk of its brain. there's this conflict all the time between not hurting the animal and actually being able to study the circuit in its normal state. And there's a level of access for physiology that is just not possible in vivo, that is possible here.
You have to anesthetize a frog.
Have to anesthetize a squid.
Not a fly.
Not a fly. No, they haven't got to the flies yet. Lobsters are close. Yeah. It's. I know, I'm a big fan of flies too.
How long can you keep?
About 6 to 8 hours in really good shape. It starts to. What happens is within the cortex, which is sort of over here. You start to lose an inhibition within the cortex, and so you start to see a sort of an epileptic type activity, and there's a lot of feedback from the cortex to the bulb. That's something that I didn't mention that makes it quite different, say, from the retina, is that there's actually, you haven't talked about it, there's a lot of centrifugal inputs from brain centers further up that come into the bulb to modulate its synapses, and the main target being the granule cells. And so you begin to see epileptiform activity in the brain. But we have many hours when we can really work with a brain that's in very good shape. Far and away, the more difficult problem is keeping the nose alive. It's normally being having blood flowing through it, and it likes to keep itself moist and gooey, and it's hard to keep the nose functioning properly. We do some work in the frog in vivo. And that's what actually this shows, is a recording made from a field recording made during an odor application in vivo, followed by the removal of that brain from the same frog, and about a half an hour later, a recording made from a similar portion of the brain when it's in the dish. But when you want to apply drugs, it's a lot easier if the brain is exposed and you can perfuse things over it. When you want to go whole cell and record from a neuron, full neuron deep down, it's a lot easier to do if the brain is laid out in a dish than if it's in the animal. Frogs, fortunately, over mammals, have an advantage that when you anesthetize them, actually paralyze them and cut their heads off, they stop breathing, and they breathe through their skin. Whereas mammals have to be ventilated all the time, so the amount of movement of the brain is much reduced. There's so many complications with working in vivo. I'm not arguing that one should not work in vivo by any stretch, but what I tried to do is find something where I could do a lot of work in between with this isolated brain. Well, there is no blood, and that's one of the nice things about lower vertebrates, turtles and frogs. You can deliver enough oxygen through the bath, the cortex, the whole thing is about a millimeter thick, so it's sort of twice the thickness of a regular brain slice. But you're running at a lower temperature, the normal temperature, and that's another important thing. This is the temperature it normally runs at, not how we tend to do our brain slices, which is we'll bring them up to 37 degrees, we'll do some quick experiments, and then it's over because you can't keep it alive at that temperature in the dish. So there's a lot of experiments are done at 30, 29. Some people even do experiments at room temperature. All the kinetics are just messed up. All the channel kinetics are messed up. The Q10 for transmitter release is extremely steep. So there's serious problems with doing experiments in brain slice at low temperature. High temperature, they die very quickly. It's very hard to do. These things will survive quite well. In fact, just an aside, and you didn't hear it from me, you can take all the blood out of a frog, replace it with saline, and let them hop around. And they'll go for days like that. They really don't need the red blood cells at all. I don't know what the red blood cells are there for. Anyways, but you didn't hear that here.
Vapor.
What's that?
Vapor.
Go all.
Too late.
I didn't say that. Just kidding. Anyway. Oh, dear. But it's quite remarkable. Turtles, I could go into turtles. I could tell you all sorts of lore. Yeah, exactly. Turtles actually, because they hibernate, have a whole half of their metabolism that runs anaerobically. And they can actually maintain their brain in quite a reasonable state without oxygen at all. It's not running at full tilt, but they have enough anaerobic metabolism to actually keep it functioning. So if you just help it along with superfused, highly oxygenated saline coming over pH buffered zone, it'll last very, very well. Oops, sorry.
With the tubes,
right.
When you write in vitro, do you mean slice, or do you mean
I mean that.
Okay,
yeah. We can't really slice this thing, unfortunately. We're having a lot of trouble slicing. We're not the only ones. The lower vertebrate brains are kind of soft. They don't have as much glia. They don't have as much myelin. So the slicing process is much more difficult. The tissue just seems not to withstand it. So we've just kind of avoided doing that. But there are some reasons that we need to slice it. We'd really like to slice it. So we use these IRDIC techniques to actually see what we're going after. And so we're working on embedding it in agar and trying to find ways to slice it. But everything you'll see for me would be in a whole brain. So just finally, the last of the technical things. So one of the things that this was really useful for, made very facile, was to use a combination of electrophysiology and optics to study the function of elements within the olfactory bulb. So what we're doing here is developing a technique to apply a dextran conjugated calcium indicator. Dextran is a big molecule. Once the calcium green is conjugated to it, if the dextran can get inside a cell, the cell won't spit it out, and so you can keep it inside cells for days and days and days. And so we were able to apply this to a portion of the bulb that just happened to be in the frogs. There's a place where there are no glomeruli lying over top, and all of the neuropil is an area of interaction between the granule cells and the mitral cells. And so by applying some dye into this area here, we could get it to be picked up by the dendrites, the secondary dendrites of these mitral cells. And then once it's inside the cell, it gets transported throughout the mitral cell. And then we could then direct our imaging over to the glomerular layer somewhere well away from where we made the injection and look at the calcium transients that are in that are occurring in the dendrites of these mitral cells. The reason we're doing this is not so much because we're interested in calcium fluxes or concentrations per se, but calcium is a very good indicator. It's the only indicator we really have that's particularly useful of electrical activity. It's always associated with some level of electrical activity because of the voltage, the influx occurs through voltage-sensitive calcium channels. So it's only when you get a depolarization that you'll have a calcium influx. And so you can use it to learn something about which neurons are active and when and in which parts of them. And these are just some images of mitral cell apical dendrite coming up and then ramifying within a glomerulus. Here's another one that's coming up and ramifying probably in the same glomerulus. We end up getting one or a couple cells in any given glomerulus. So I'm filling a small portion of the total population. So it's not total chaos. The bottom are some wide field views of what it looks like. And these, of course, are actually two photon scanning microscopy images, which give you a sort of an optical section to them. Okay. And I'm going to now start to go a little faster because I want to get to the meat, and I don't want to bore you with my life. But here's probably one of the more important things that we found very, very soon when we started this kind of study is that as you would predict, the difference in the activity and the difference in the calcium fluxes when one stimulates with an odor versus when one stimulates with a nerve shock are quite dramatic and different in important ways, a couple of which I'll tell you about. Of course, you see here, these are multiple stimulations with an odor, increasing the odor intensity. And these are the local field responses, the oscillatory local field responses that result from that. This is the equivalent of a single sniff, a single inhalation of an odor.
So the local field potential, the amplitude stays the same, even though you change the
field? Well, the amplitude of the first component stays the same. The amplitude, actually, this is the weakest one down here, and that's getting stronger, but it's very shallow. You're absolutely right. There's not this dramatic difference between a strong odorant and a strong odor application and a weak odor application. Once you get past a certain threshold, they look pretty much the same. There's very little change in the frequency. You might have a little higher frequency oscillations at the beginning with the stronger stimulus than with the weaker stimulus. But the overall envelope is very, very similar. Yeah. And then the above signal is a calcium signal recorded from the dislabeled dendrites of probably two mitral cells in the same glomerulus. Okay, I'm not differentiating between the different dendrites of these two that came into this glomerulus. And you see, this is quite dramatic. And just take it from me in terms of the amplitude, the duration. This is a lot of calcium coming into these dendrites. Not altogether surprising, remember, that because these dendrites are presynaptic terminals. So they're invested with calcium channels, voltage sensitive. They're also invested with NMDA receptors, as we'll see in a moment, which have a calcium flux to them. So there's a lot of opportunity for calcium to come in. Try as we might with nerve shock, though, we're much less successful at generating calcium fluxes into the tuft. We don't elicit any oscillations, obviously. You have excitation followed by inhibition. And it's only at the very highest stimulations, at the point where we're reaching the limit of what we can stimulate because we start to burn the nerve, that we start to get some evidence for a late sort of humpy component that I'll show you is actually the indication of an NMDA component to the PSC. So what this slide is just to show you is that when you're using a nerve shock, or if you're in a slice and you're stimulating, let's say, afferents, and you have normal inhibition present, normal magnesium present, you get the impression that, or you find that for a relatively weak nerve stimulation, that is one that doesn't activate a lot of afferents, the input, the excitatory input, is all AMPA receptor mediated, all CNQX sensitive. There's little or nothing that is blocked by AP5, so it's although you have both sets of receptors on the dendrite, if you only bring a few inputs in, the only response that you're going to get, either electrically or from a calcium point of view, will be due to the activation of the AMPA receptor. If you turn things up really strongly, so that you have a lot of inputs coming in, then you can begin to see an AMPA component. I mean, an NMDA component, and we see that in the calcium as an increase in the amount of calcium that's coming in and a delay in the time to peak. It gets spread out a little bit in time because you remember those NMDA receptors tend to stay open longer. And so they bring calcium in over a longer time period. And you can block part of the influx with an AMPA blocker, and then you can block the majority of it with the NMDA blocker. So you have this impression, and this was totally consistent with what you see if you're doing electrical recordings from the mitral cells, that the input looks to be sort of equally divided or fairly closely equally divided between an NMDA dependent and an AMPA receptor dependent input. Whereas when you use an odor, and these have yet to be done, similar experiments have yet to be done in a mammal, but when you use an odor, the AMPA has almost no effect, or it doesn't block. The AMPA blocker, like CNQX, doesn't block the calcium influx, and it doesn't even block the odor-evoked oscillations. Whereas where AP5 blocking the NMDA receptor knocks out the oscillations, it knocks out almost all of the calcium influx. It really destroys the excitation of the network by an odor. So, two things that I'll give you as take-home messages. I'll give you my reasoning on it. Why is it that two things that you see here that we need to focus on? The first The first is that there seems to be more calcium influx when we have an AMPA blocker in place. We've blocked this. This should be very non-intuitive to you, illogical. We've gotten rid of one of the major excitatory receptors coming into the system by this blockade with CNQX. Yet we've got more calcium coming into our distal apical dendrite. We have at least as strong, if not stronger, oscillations in the network. We're driving the network better than we were when these receptors were intact. If we use an odor, if we use a nerve shock, no, we seriously knock out the inputs. But with an odor, we're driving it better. That paradox can be resolved, I think, in a moment. And the duration of the calcium influx that we've been seeing is much longer with odors than with nerve shocks. And so where can that come from? To get a hint of where I think that comes from, to a large extent, where this is coming from, we need to look at what happens if you try to stimulate repetitively. All right, you might say an odor comes into the nose, it hangs around for a period of time, it activates receptors over a period of time. In fact, I need an eraser. If you were to make single unit recordings from olfactory receptor neurons, pick any olfactory receptor neuron in the nose, what do you see when you put an odorant on? Not single unit. Let's go intercellular into a receptor cell. You'll see something that looks like that with a time scale, let's say, of, we'll put 1 second on there. You'll see a receptor potential that builds up slowly, relatively slowly, and then a series of spikes, right? This is mediated by the second method. This whole transduction process of the odor into an electrical signal is mediated by second messenger systems within the...
Delay is about half a second, really?
Well, let's be careful. It depends. This is, I picked one cell, okay? In this cell, I've got about a half a second delay. This would be like for a frog. If I was working in a rat, you'd compress everything by a factor of 10. So it'd be maybe a 50 millisecond delay. But
everything
I could.
Everything including the whole cycle.
Yeah, and even.
So it's about half of the breathing cycle.
Exactly. Yeah, it's something on an. It sort of. You're right. It sort of matches something that has to do with the normal rate of breathing. But a different cell may look like this, where it fires early. There's quite a distribution of the timings of the receptor cells, which is what I was alluding to earlier, why it was important to be able to tickle why we thought it would be important to get back to tickling the network with odors as opposed to nerve shocks, is because of this ability, this limitation with nerve shocks of having all of your inputs come in at the same time, whereas normally the network receives inputs at different points within the glomerular sheet at different times. So there's a distribution of times over which these things begin to turn on, mainly relating, I think, to the how well the receptor is being driven by the odorant, and then how long does it take, given that amount of drive, to get the second messenger systems to build up second messengers to a sufficient level that they can open up enough channels to depolarize the cell. Yeah. Right. So what you see, it does and it doesn't. So there is a dependence on odor in as much as the following, that as you increase the odorant, when you find a cell that's responding well to the odorant, you will shift the delay back. But there's always a minimum. And in some cells, if they start out here, you can only shift them back, you know, to here. And I took that slide out because I didn't want to give one. I was hoping to talk about more than just frogs. But we've done that experiment with the mitral cells of increasing the odor intensity. And you can sort of see it actually here in this one. You see how as we've increased the intensity of our wide range, there's a little shift backwards in the time to onset. Okay. What's important, though, is, and in the slide that I left out, which would be, if it's still here, slideshow view. I don't know how to do this. View outline. No, slide sorter. See if it's here. We're way down here, so you know we're well on our way to the... But I didn't toss it in, sorry. Is it... escape. Go to the one I want, which was... Nope, here. Is that they move in parallel, so that one that's what happens with the mitral cells is that if you've got one that's being activated late, as you increase the intensity, it moves back. If you've got one that's activated earlier, as you increase the intensity, it moves back too. So they maintain to a significant degree a relative timing for the onset of their activity as you move up through concentration, even though the exact timing may vary. Does
that make... activity of the receptor is increased?
What in a general sense, I'm having brain lock. The activity is increased. What tends to happen is you have something that looks like that. May look like that at a low concentration will tend to move back and cluster into a tighter burst at the beginning, followed by some adaptation. So there's a shifting of the spikes to a shorter.
Well, that's interesting because it means that what the mitral cells receive is actually a special temporal pattern.
Always. It's a special. What a mitral cell sees is a temporal pattern. Not a spatial, okay. What the bulb sees is spatial temporal, but what a mitral sees...
cells will get different temporal parts.
That's right. And I think it's very important to bring into your gestalt the fact that it's not the same input every time. I mean, odorants, when you smell them, are never the same concentration. I'll put, any odorant in this room, and as you move around, or as it comes to you, it will change its concentration a lot, and we know that these receptors are then delivering a different, individually, if you look at any one of them, is delivering a different input to its mitral cells that it's connected to, always. So, I get very confused and very, like, intimidated by the fact that it's such a mess. There has to be something, have to be mechanisms after the fact to deal with the fact that there's no absolute onset time, there's no absolute offset time, and there's not even anything that you could say was constant in terms of the number of spikes and how they were distributed in time. What does appear to be true, though, is that to a first approximation, receptors maintain, by virtue of the fact that there's just sort of chemistry and titration going on with affinities for particular odorants on any of these receptors, there is a correspondence as you move up and down the concentration scale to a first approximation of ones that are more sensitive being activated very soon, or sooner than the ones that are less sensitive. As you move further and further away to lower concentrations, some of them drop out entirely, and as you go to the lowest concentrations, you end up with literally one or two glomeruli being activated for particular odorants. You can see that, but this system has to be inherently set up to deal with, I would say, a lot of uncertainty, or at least a lot of variability in the nature of the signal that's coming in, just for concentration alone, for one odor, to be able to tell that an odor is the same thing over a wide range of concentrations.
But if you try to compare this uncertainty or variability, let's say the mitral cells and the receptors, what would be your impression?
It's reduced by the time you get to the mitral cells. And one of the points of debate is to what extent is this reduced by the lateral, by the granule cell network, and then there's another school that's touting the importance of the paraglomerular, the glomerular networks, and that's where I'm going to go right now. Okay, finally, I'm going to get to that first topic, is to show you what happens if you stimulate repetitively. The olfactory bulb, and then when I finish this, I'll stop and we can grab a coffee. Okay, there is profound paired pulse depression within the olfactory bulb if you stimulate electrically. You really cannot drive this thing, this network, repetitively at all. That was again why we had to go back to odors. It's because you can't try to create something that's like an odor input by repeatedly stimulating, right? You can't deliver a bunch of action potentials from afferent fibers in and distribute that input over time at all. You can't split the nerve up into separate bundles and try to stimulate one and then the other. We tried all that, and what kills you is this paired pulse depression that is very long lasting. So a single stimulus followed up to 3, 4, 5, 6 seconds later will show less activation of the network. And what you're looking at in these three records are whole cell recordings, patch on breakthrough of a mitral cell. We've blocked the granule cell GABA A mediated inhibition. There isn't any of that present at this point. So we got rid of that pharmacologically. And yet we're still left with an enormous amount of paired pulse depression. The input coming into, so now we're just looking at the monosynaptic input from the afferent fibers into the mitral cell. And you see if you stimulate twice, you've got, you know, a fraction of the input coming into those mitral cells.
Where were we?
The olfactory nerve electrically. So, and you can do the same thing with and then you're recording in a mitral cell. And this is frog, this is rat, this is turtle, this is you, this is everybody. Okay? This is not a peculiarity to frog. I could have gone to the literature, Xeroxed rat papers and used those examples, but I decided to use frog instead. I'm not going to build up any suspense here. The paired pulse depression is mediated by GABA B receptors that are located on the presynaptic terminals themselves. You can mimic to a certain extent this paired pulse depression by using an agonist of GABA B receptors, the ubiquitous agonist baclofen. If you apply baclofen to the cells, then stimulate, you see you have a much reduced, at the same intensity, much reduced postsynaptic current in the mitral cells. And instead of paired pulse depression, now we've, in a sense, by turning on this system maximally with the baclofen, now anything that's released by the network can't turn it on anymore. All right, so you don't have paired pulse depression anymore, because I will tell you, the paraglomerular cells can release all the GABA they want. They can't go and activate any more receptors. They're already active. So when you do that, you effectively block any additional paired pulse, any additional inhibition by endogenous release GABA. And what you see instead is facilitation. Now, what's important, there's two things, reasons why I wanted to show you this, is not only to discuss, you know, the ins and outs of what's going on here, but also to remind you and make you keenly aware of the fact that there's facilitation is probably going on all the time in all, you know, virtually all synapses to some extent. It's very often, though, masked by some form of depression, either a depletion of transmitter, which is what I think Misha was referring to when he asked me in the beginning, you're going to talk about depression or how is this different from depression, or it's masked by some sort of network-mediated, i.e., transmitter-mediated inhibition of release. So once you get rid of that, either by turning it on so it can't be turned on anymore, or by using an antagonist of the GABA B receptor. So if you put a good antagonist on, you can then actually begin to see the facilitation start to break through. It's an underlying process all the time, and the output that you get from any synapse is always a balance. I mean, I'm making broad blanket statements here, but I think they're quite legitimate, that virtually any synapse that you're going to look at, or the vast majority of the synapses you're going to look at, when you look at the output of that synapse with repetitive stimulation, you're looking at a combination of processes that are working to increase release and processes that are working to decrease release. In some synapses, the net result of those two processes working against each other is a remarkably constant output from that synapse over time. If you were to, and we know that they're both present, even in synapses like this, because we can play with the things that are causing it to depress and play with the things that are causing it to facilitate selectively, by means that if you want, I'll tell you later, and actually see the facilitation that was there but hidden, or we can see the depression that was there or hidden. And the net result of what you see is always a combination of two. And different synapses tune the amount of depression, depletion, whatever, and the amount of facilitation, augmentation, potentiation that they have. They tune them, they balance them relative to one another to give a kind of output that is appropriate for what they're trying to do. So one thing this kind of presynaptic inhibition that I'm going to show you how it works in the next slide, what it can do is transform a synapse from one that is very effective for transmitting low frequencies, you know, the first and early on in the stimulus train, and then shutting off, to one that doesn't necessarily transmit very well until there's been repetitive stimuli, right? You can turn it from a low pass to a high pass filters just by playing with the amount of depression or depletion, either endogenously by expressing certain proteins and setting it up in the beginning so that that's the way it is, or by turning on modulatory systems that'll come in and selectively turn up the facilitation or turn down the depression, okay? Soon. So this is the picture that you'll find in Shepherd, and which is, although it's published in 1998, it appears to be about 2 years out of date from that, that shows nothing going on to these presynaptic terminals. But in fact, what happens is that the GABA that's released by the paraglomerular cell into this space can migrate over. Now, I told you, with a closed space and everything's packed very closely together, migrate over and activate GABA-B receptors on the presynaptic terminals of some of the olfactory neuron afferents. As it turns out, it looks like this drawing that I made here, which is, you know, my drawing, is actually quite accurate in that I only put a GABA-B receptor on the olfactory neuron afferents that are going to the mitral cell. The ones that are going to the paraglomerular cell, you know, that class of paraglomerular cells that are getting driven by the olfactory nerve, they don't seem to have GABA-B receptors on them, or they have very little in the way of GABA-B receptors on them, so that they're not turned down that much. We know that from studies in which we've actually measured in peripulse depression in paraglomerular cells, whereas in a mitral cell, you'll see something that looks like what I've just shown you here. You know, this massive, or it showed you in the other one, the massive depression. If you're in a paraglomerular cell, you see almost no peripulse depression in a paraglomerular cell that's being activated by the olfactory nerve stimulus. So paraglomerular depression can be tuned to one set of afferents or another, even though the GABA, and why am I hammering this point? Because conceptually, I'm really messing up people who want to try to do circuit modeling, because now there's no even defined connection. It's not like the paraglomerular cell makes this lovely anatomical connection onto a presynaptic afferent that you could, you know, find in an EM and say, you know, he must be connected to him. It's dumping GABA into the space around these terminals, and it's percolating everywhere. It has just as much chance to hit these terminals as it does to hit those terminals. So in order to get some sort of specificity, it's up to the terminal to decide which receptor is being expressed. And the system does that, so that we see...
Functionally, it's like turning up and down the efficacy of these receptors, how they act on the mitral cell.
The olfactory nerve, these terminals, you see.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's like a switch. Right?
It's a switch, but it's a little bit more than a switch, in as much as, remember here, I tried to make the story a little more interesting. It's not just turning it down; it actually can change the way in which information is transferred through. It changes it from something that would have a large gain and put an input through early on, and then just ignore what was coming in later. You know, later spikes coming in would not be, to one that would require a train of action potentials before it might get to the point of releasing enough transmitter to be able to drive the mitral cell. That is to say, you don't have to think of it as simply turning off this. In an intermediate, there's a spectrum, depending on how much GABA you've released and how many of these receptors are being activated. You can go from being transferring information, driving this mitral cell with a couple of spikes early on, to one where you only drive the mitral cell if you have repetitive stimulus.
This changes the timing, right?
I'm trying to suggest that this has the potential to change the timing. Yeah, from being something that would do well for this, but and really only maybe even just pay attention to the first spike, to something that would actually may require repetitive stimuli spread over many, many spikes spread over some period of time in order to build up the facilitation. So it's a little more than just turning the gain up and down. But it's, to a first approximation, yes, it's a turning up and a turning down of the gain. Remember that these periglomerular cells are set up this way, so that they have a dendrite here, but then they have an axon that goes over to an adjacent glomerulus, so that they can receive their input from this set of afferents, but then they can deliver their inhibition over to this part of another group of mitral cells that would be receiving input from a different odorant. So through this mechanism of being able to turn down both the mitral cell directly with a GABA A shunt here, and by being able to control the release of transmitter from an adjacent terminal, you have two mechanisms that can work to increase contrast very nicely. Right? You have one that will also do gain control, which we've talked about as being something that it seems to be needed in order to take into the account the fact that the receptor cells can have a broad range of firing rates depending upon the intensity of the odor. You have this sense that there's got to be something to deal with that, and this smells very much like something that would be good for doing that, for not turning off. You know, you don't release. You need. Remember, I said it's the GABA that's released into the space. You actually need to release a lot of GABA for it to diffuse over and to be effective on these GABA things. So a little bit of activity in the periglomerular cells doesn't actually lead to much paired pulse depression. A lot of activity does. So what I showed you here was an example where we stimulated very strongly and we got a lot of paired pulse depression. I could show you another slide where by decreasing the intensity of the initial stimulus, so that you don't activate very many afferents, and as a consequence, you don't activate as many periglomerular cells, you actually have much less paired pulse depression. So that it would be about this big, say it would be about that big, and then the next one would be 3/4 as large. Instead of being 1/5 the size, it would be almost as big. So the system is set up in a way so that it increases the amount of inhibition as the intensity of the stimulus comes up. All right. And the bottom line, where we've come into this in my lab in a big way is in a particular way is to try and study the mechanism by which this is affected. And these are then measurements made from presynaptic terminals filled in the way that I described way at the beginning of the talk with this calcium indicator, showing the transient of calcium, or a measurement of the calcium influx in response to an action potential coming into the terminals. This is a series of them where you see the actual amount of calcium that's coming in with each subsequent stimulus is dropping from stimulus 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 to 5. So I'm stimulating I filled the presynaptic terminals with calcium green dextran, and now I'm electrically stimulating the axons. And I'm looking with a photomultiplier tube at the change in fluorescence that I'm seeing in these terminals. An increase in fluorescence indicates an increase in calcium into the terminal. And it's in this case, at this level, it actually scales fairly linearly with fluorescence scales linearly with the amount of calcium. So the fact that this here is about 1/3 of from here to here means that about 1/3 as much calcium came into the presynaptic terminal. What that means is that the GABA B receptor is coupled to second messengers that go and interact with the N-type calcium channels that are on the presynaptic terminal. So it's regulating release predominantly by shutting down the calcium channels that are in the presynaptic terminal.
I used to think that second messenger system is slow, but here it works from one spike to another.
Well, slow in relative terms.
Yeah.
It turns out that if you plot, just looking at the calcium, either the calcium decrease or the transmitter release decrease as a function of time, there's a point where you can't stimulate these things at 100 hertz. They're not. These aren't made to go that rate. But it's something that looks like that. where the peak appears to be at about 100 to 200 milliseconds.
If you give two pulses with like 10 milliseconds,
you see,
well, you don't see, you won't see much depression.
You don't see that much depression. Part of the reason you don't see depression. Almost none.
Almost.
Okay, in the PSP, you do see some in the calcium. And the reason, though, that you see almost none, I would argue, in the PSP is that at the short intervals, facilitation is compensating a bit for the suppression. So you have a facilitation of release process that's, you know, I told you, is always masked in there. So it actually helps to compensate a bit for the loss of calcium. But the peak calcium decline and the peak suppression of release occurs in a frog at about 200 milliseconds. And actually, I've drawn it. It really should be much more like that, you know, if that's 200 milliseconds. It goes on for many, many seconds. So there's two kinds of slow. There's slow in the onset, and there's persistent. I mean, your eye runs off of second messengers. You know, vision is entirely dependent upon turning up and turning down of G proteins. Yet we don't think of vision as a slow process. There are ways, many, many ways that one can take second messenger systems and make them fast by having an antagonistic, I don't know how much, you know, you have two antagonistic second messengers, the systems that are always operating at a relatively high rate. So you have a phosphorylation and a dephosphorylation, and they're always ongoing, and each of those enzymes is running at a very high rate, and then all you do is you modulate one up or the other down. And then the other path can push against they can push against each other, so that actually you can end up with quite reasonable fidelity. Even though the intrinsic time course, say if you turned off the production of something, you know, how long would it take for it to go away? On its own, can be very, very slow. If you've got a system there that's chewing it up, and you're in a dynamic equilibrium, then just by shifting the dynamic, the point of equilibrium left and right, you can create quite reasonable kinetics.
It takes minutes to adapt to the dark, right?
It takes minutes to adapt to a dark, but second messengers are involved in the phototransduction process all the time, right? The sodium channels.
Transduction, not only in the contrast.
No. The sodium channel that's generating the current is a cyclic GMP-mediated channel. It's not a voltage-regulated channel at all. So the channel is actually causing the current in your photoreceptors. It's changing. As I move my eyes around, it's being controlled by a second messenger that's produced through the activation of the rhodopsin. What makes it go have reasonable temporal fidelity is that there's something else sitting right here trying to, you know, pull a cyclic GMP off. And so you're in this fight all the time between the two systems. And both of them are working quite fast.
Still, with this time, so you give a first pulse. The first pulse should activate the peripheral membranes.
Right.
So it should release gamma. Gamma should diffuse back to the sulfactant nerve. And by this time of the second pulse, there should be a very strong depression. So
this
should include a lot of other things, not just the second messenger pulse, but also diffusible gamma.
That's right. Right. So the slowness. So that's right.
It's like for the second messenger, you will have much less time.
This is true. I mean, I didn't. I was using this as a pedagogical lesson. I was giving a lesson in second messengers, not so much. It's true. This is slow. I would say this is slow. But I just wanted to kind of, you know, get on the soapbox and say, don't immediately assume that second messenger has to be slow. The reason that this works so fast. Another reason this works so fast is that everything's kind of localized in membranes and put physically very close together inside the photoreceptor. And Misha's point is very well taken, that we're talking about the fact that you have to diffuse over distances that are quite large.
And EG7 reacts immediately to the photopulse.
Yeah. So at least our measurements of periglomerular cells show that they have very high input impedances. And the release of only a few afferents, the current from release from a few afferents is sufficient to drive them to the threshold. So they're very punchy cells. And I have recorded from them in mammals in rat, and by accident en route to mitral cells, and they fire at extremely high rates, hundreds of hertz, and they're always sitting fairly close to threshold, and they've got a lot of synaptic noise coming into them because of spontaneous activity in the sensory cells. So they're poised right at the edge of of firing. But when an odor comes in, they just go bananas. So they fire a very high frequency burst, like that. Much more like what you're used to thinking of in visual system, and is as common is commonly the case throughout the nervous system for small interneurons. Small interneurons tend to be really punchy, very high frequency firing, very fast spikes, and these paraglomerular cells fit in with that norm. Anyway, just to show you what. Then I've given you a story, and you ask, you know, can you see evidence of this kind of thing happening inside the frog? Absolutely. This is just some two photon images of these tufts, and we have one glomerulus here, another glomerulus there, and another glomerulus over here. There's at least two cells, I think, coming into this glomerulus. I have no idea how many are going into the ones on either side. And then these are plots of calcium transients as a function of time after an odor application. And you see some of this richness of temporal dynamics. I can posit, although I didn't do the experiment on this particular prep, I know that it would increase. This is actually very strong odor stimulation. This is not a weak one. So this is about as fast as it's ever going to go. If I go to lower intensities, what will happen is this one will probably drop out. These two would slide over to the right, so there'd be a slightly longer delay. This one would slide a little bit to the right, this difference in time here is not a reflection of some particular, my choosing a particular concentration of odorant. These relative timings are at least in the sense of early versus late, are maintained throughout the. So that's what it actually looks like in real time if you were looking through the microscope. It sort of goes at about that rate. In that there's a few hundred milliseconds in between when one set of cells gets turned on and another set of cells gets turned on. Each of those things is corresponding to the rise in calcium. And so we've started now. Now we're going back, having sort of sorted out the fact that these interactions are there between the paraglomerular cells and the presynaptic afferents, that we know something about the fact that there are differences in timing. And now what we're for the, you know, the next paper, what we want to show is this actually functioning to both change the pattern of who's activated and when in the mitral cells, so like that last movie, but now start adding in a GABA B blocker. And this is our first beginnings of that kind of work, where we're recording intracellularly whole cell current. So this is voltage clamp. So upwards is inhibition and downwards is excitation. We're recording from a mitral cell while we're applying an odor, or two different odors to the nose. In the black traces with normal ringers for odor one and for odor two. And then the red trace is after we've added the GABA B blocker, CGP, whatever it is, gotten rid of the majority of this paripulse depression, this presynaptic afferent inhibition. And for this odor, there's basically no effect. And for this odor, there's a huge effect. So what this means is that for the particular mitral cell that we managed to find, and this particular pair of odors, and of course to expand it out, one has to work through a lot more odor combinations, that this cell was receiving, that the afferents going to this cell were receiving a fair amount of presynaptic inhibition when odor 2 was coming on, but not that much when odor 1 was coming on.
These are single traces,
yeah. One can average them, and don't worry. But I actually like to show single traces more than averages. Because it gives you a sense of you know kind of how much variability one can see, and also, well, it doesn't actually, but it doesn't give you as much of a sense of that you like to see, but it gives you a sense of how big a change one can hope to see on a single trial. Because for one thing, you can't do a lot of trials when you're doing odor research, because everything takes so long to come back to the ground state, these adaptations, that if you have to average 100, you're never going to be able to do anything.
We have to wait like
2 minutes. 2 minutes. 2 minutes between every trial, yeah, for each odor and each.
Next time you will do it, you will see
it. Once it's up, it's up, and once it stays up, yeah. Not a problem. I appreciate that you'd like to have seen that, but the graduate student sent me these, and that's all I had to work with. And that's so that's where I'll stop at this point. I think this is going to be an important part, anyway, in the next little while of the work in the olfactory bulb, sorting out the role of presynaptic inhibition in this periglomerular network, and how this is probably involved in gain control as well as contrast enhancement. So it's up to you. I can certainly should. Yeah, I think we should take a break. That was the long story. The other thing I want to talk about will be very quick, maybe half an hour. It's okay. So one of the is that as the metabotropic as the glutamate is released from this dendrite, it's going to activate the metabotropic glutamate receptor on this spine only. And so it will turn off the feedback inhibition on this spine only. This guy, this spine here, is not receiving any release from this mitral cell because it's not being active. So it maintains its lateral inhibition. So there's a very simple way for the system to first to sort of tune out the local feedback inhibition and maintain the lateral inhibition. How this actually leads to the Bruce effect is what's not known. I mean, how you go from this molecular what we call disinhibition is the term, disinhibition. So at first, the granule cell here inhibits the mitral cell that's driving it, but if that mitral cell continues to be driven, it can release enough glutamate into this space. And remember, we're talking metabotropic receptors, that are typically, I've drawn it wrong, off to the side. Metabotropic receptors tend not to be clustered right underneath the site where the transmitter is released. Whenever you have metabotropic receptors on a presynaptic terminal, which is what this is equivalent to, they tend to be a little bit outside of the so-called active zone cleft region. So it usually requires there to be a fair amount of transmitter to be released over a reasonably long period of time for that glutamate to be able to spread out and then activate them. Okay, so if this mitral cell gets driven for strongly enough and for a long enough period of time, then this will turn on and then gate out the release of GABA. And so this will actually then become stronger and stronger, provided it's driven strongly in the first place. If it only gets a little bit of drive, then it'll be shut off and it won't be able to overcome.
So this is a short-term effect now.
This is a short, yeah, this per se is a short-term effect. It's only present for tens of seconds after the glutamate has been around in terms of the downregulation of...
There's no way of encoding a memory.
Well, so there are ways that one can imagine, okay, of encoding a memory. I'll give you an example that'll be very easy for you. You know, you've heard of LTP. You hear about LTP all the time. Hang on, don't dismiss it. There is an example of something where the calcium influx into the postsynaptic spine occurs over the course of a second, and then it's cleaned up. But the second messenger-mediated activation, the phosphorylations, and even then later on the ultimate retuning of the genetic machinery to express different receptors, persists for a very, very long time afterwards. Right. So you don't actually have to necessarily have sustained activation of the metabotropic receptor in order for events such as for plasticity events to be long-lasting. One consequence of this that you can immediately imagine is that if you take off the inhibitory feedback regulation of the spine, now the driving of the AMPA receptors is going to be very, very effective, right? Because you're going to get more and more release and you're not going to turn it off. So you can imagine there could be some huge calcium influxes into that spine, more so than you would normally get. Normally you'd get a little calcium influx and it'd be shut off. But if you keep it going, then you'll get a calcium influx that will grow and be maintained for several seconds, which in the case of LTP, that's all it takes, really. The activation of an NMDA receptor and a whole bunch of calcium is all it takes to induce that long-lasting change in synaptic plasticity at this particular synapse. So I don't have the answer, but it's not hard to imagine how or not hard to imagine that the potential is there for there to be a long-lasting change at this particular spine and not at that particular spine. But the fact is, though, that you can mimic the Bruce effect. You can, you don't need the mating part. You just take the male rat. I mean, you don't need the mating part in the first place. You can take the male mouse and put him around the female mouse, and then inject her with a blocker of an activator of that mGluR2 subtype receptor, and induce the Bruce effect in that mouse in the absence of the actual mating. So you can substitute what you would see in the absence of mating. I don't know whether the experiment is to artificially inseminate the mouse, or she won't eat the babies that are produced by another mouse. Like, so here's what it is. Females eat the babies. Yeah, I know it is. Yeah, so I think I haven't read it, but I think what you do is you mate the mouse to one mouse, okay? And then normally, if you take that mouse away and you deliver another mouse and you keep him around and you take away the smell of the other mouse and you just leave her exposed to this one mouse for a long period of time, she will abort that pregnancy. But if you inject her with the activator of this receptor while you're waving the new mouse around, she won't abort she'll carry the pregnancy through to term. I think it's the way in which the experiment's done.
You take away the Bruce effect of the first mouse and you...
That's right. Then you induce it to the second mouse. Exactly right. Yeah. And the Bruce effect, I don't know if you take away you could induce another. I don't know whether or not you actually now, if she brings, I don't know what the case is. If you bring the old mouse back, does she then abort the pregnancy or not? That I don't know.
So what's the evolutionary sense of this? I mean, it's like she holds back from eating her own children because her husband.
Well, when I say eat, I'm talking about this is resorption of pregnancies. Okay, I was being a bit glib when I'm talking about. Mice eat their babies when they're stressed. Hamsters eat their babies when they're stressed.
Right.
Okay, one thing that would create stress would be a male around who wasn't the father of those mice, because he would be trying to eat them too and attacking them. Male mice do eat other mice, but the females eat them too whenever they're upset.
So male do eat them when they're relaxed, and female when they're stressed.
So the Bruce effect is not a female mouse eating its young.
Okay. So it's an abortion.
No, it's an abortion effect. That's my recollection of it.
No, because certainly standard that the males will destroy the offspring
within
the
prior
males.
Right.
That makes
evolutionary
sense.
Doesn't really matter.
Provided she's capable of producing offspring rapidly.
Their own genes. Right,
exactly. Yeah. So unless the male could then tell after they're born that they're not his.
Right.
So then she's preemptively aborting.
That's not a problem.
they can
smell. Yeah, they smell these immunohistocompatibility complexes that relate. Immunohistocompatibility. It has to do with reduction of it. We have we have blood types, right? We have certain blood types are compatible, certain others are incompatible. We have a whole immune system that is identifies us, one organ to another when you try to transfer or transplant organs. So there are these complexes of immunocompatibility that exist between different individuals. And there's a theory around that, finding the perfect mate does involve pheromones, and it involves finding a match between someone whose immunological profile is matched to your immunological profile, and this is actually the underlying basis. I mean, you laugh. It's the underlying basis of love at first sight, etc. I mean, why do some people absolutely turn you off? And I'm an example of something that relates to that is involved here, where an individual mouse has got a profile that is recognizable to another mouse, and it's mediated through this.
That's a contradiction, right? First you say there is some genetic something, I cannot smell this guy. But then you say, under certain circumstances, this can be switched.
Well, you said I can't smell them. My problem is I actually smell them. Can't stand them. Yeah. Well, we're a slightly more socially complex beast than a mouse.
Then you say you can learn, so to say, to like him.
What I think, yeah. Well, let's just say maybe if you were a female and you...
It's not an injection of something, right?
Well, maybe if you were a female and you actually produced children with that individual and therefore it was evolutionary important for you to cohabitate, you know, arranged marriage, whatever, maybe you would change. It's quite possible that you would change. But I mean, it's kind of dangerous to go from a mouse doing a relatively programmed, I mean, mice don't choose their mates really, you know, the same way we do. They don't have as much opportunity to choose mates in the lab as we have, yeah.
I bet.
It could be. I don't want to keep getting myself deeper and deeper into trouble here. I wanted to just illustrate that.
Did you turn on the microphone?
Oh yeah, I did. I turned it back on. that there is this mechanism to control the output of mitral cells. I think it's very likely that this is actually involved, not just in learning. I mean, this kind of plasticity would be very good for just tuning. This setting up this spatial temporal pattern that Gilles alluded to as being present in insects that we see lots of evidence of during the first few sniffs, the exposure to an odor, the development of this kind of local plasticity, turning down some synapses and allowing others to remain high. It's probably an important part of turning the network from something that was rather diffuse down into something that's rather focused in its output. Okay, so it's an evolution, part of the evolution of the output of the network is involving the second messenger mediated control of presynaptic transmitter release.
Only the accessory olfactory ball.
It's only been studied in the accessory olfactory ball. Okay, it's one of those cherries that is at this moment hanging there in the main olfactory bulb.
So in this sense, one can say that one can identify learning in the olfactory bulb.
One can identify learning in the accessory olfactory bulb, and there's a recent paper, so you asked about the main olfactory bulb. There's a recent paper from an individual who in Memorial University in Newfoundland. What he studies is an imprinting effect of young rats that's normally part of the imprinting. It's an analog of the imprinting process of young rats for their mother, and they're like the goat story that I gave you a little while ago.
Stay away from their mother when she looks hungry, or
yeah, right. No, to actually be able to find their mother or to respond. I think what you see with young rats is when their mother comes along, they begin to try to suckle, they get excited, they'll nudge over. If you put the rat over in this side of the cage and the mother's over there, or bedding with the smell of the mother over on the other side of the cage, even though they don't see, right, they're blind, they will crawl across the cage and bury themselves in the shavings over where their mother was. So it's a nest and maternal instinct thing, not an eating thing. I can see I really disturbed you with the hamster eating its baby story there. But what he's shown is that you can take a rat pup, expose it to peppermint odor or some odor that's not being perceived by the accessory olfactory bulb, that's normally processed by the main olfactory bulb, and you can find glomeruli that respond to it and so on in the main olfactory bulb. And if you combine that odor with a stroking, and literally by hand, we're talking about just stroking, that then the animal will show a preference for that odor. So you can put peppermint over in shavings on one side of the cage, and the animal goes and buries itself in the peppermint odor. So you have you can imprint the animal to a non-pheromonal type odor in the main olfactory bulb by stroking. And as it turns out, the stroking, this paradigm, he's been able to mimic by both So this preference for the peppermint odor by injecting the same activator of the metabotropic receptor, or by injecting an activator of adrenergic receptors, so isoproterenol. And the way that story comes in is that on the presynaptic terminals, or on the spines of the granule cells, there's also metabotropic receptors for noradrenaline that appear to be coupled to the same effector system that turns down transmitter release. So you can get disinhibition in the main olfactory bulb through the activation of noradrenaline pathways from the locus ceruleus. So there's a reinforcement pathway from deep in the brain stem that is presumably, and this is where the speculation starts in, presumably turned on by maternal care, that then feeds into the same final pathway of controlling the release of transmitter from the granule spine onto the mitral cell.
But that's not specific, that probably will diffuse.
That's right. It will go to many places.
Right.
And
many spines.
That's right. It goes to many spines. And that's where in, when I reviewed this guy's grant, but what Haim's pointed out is that the noradrenaline is presumably going over onto that spine too. So
if that microcell was not activated, then no change.
Well, in this model, it wouldn't depend on activity, right? Because it's diffuse. Wouldn't depend on the activity of this mitral cell. And you're very astute. This is the criticism I made of his grant. that I had to review, which is why I know this guy's work. I'm so familiar with this. That's exactly a little bit of a hole in the argument. But you can't argue with the fact that there are these sites of modulation by the noradrenaline. They do target the release of transmitter. They may or may not involve exactly the same effector system. You can imagine a situation, though, wherein there could be a synergy. I mean, I knew how to write the guy out of his problem in his grant. is to posit a synergy between the metabotropic and the noradrenergic, so that one amplifies the other, and that would not be the least bit rococo. I mean that if they both were converging on the same effector, then the presence of a small amount of noradrenaline would turn up the metabotropic glutamate receptor's effectiveness, and that would only occur in this set of spines, and it wouldn't occur here. So that if the noradrenaline by itself can't do the disinhibition as effectively as when it's in combination with the metabotropic glutamate receptor, then you could re-establish the specificity that you recognize as absent. But the fact is that it's there. I mean, you can teach animals, you can give them a preference, you can give young rats a preference to a particular odor by adding the right level of isoproterenol to their blood. So you just put them in the presence of the blood and you add isoproterenol. You can also do it, though, by adding the right level of this DRG2, this metabotropic receptor glutamate class 2 type agonist.
So I'm sorry, yeah. Probably you're the best in the first part of the lecture, but this is one type of learning for plasticity, long-term plasticity.
Yeah, relatively long-term, because they don't maintain a preference for peppermint odor once they become adults, right? It's not, every time they smell peppermint, they start to bury themselves in shading.
But it's
relatively
about
long-term.
A year, or I don't know.
In the case of a rat, a couple of weeks. Yeah.
So, but the question is, so if you go back to the main sort of learning, skimming orders and stuff like that, the same mechanism involved or different?
Okay. Mechanism? You're asking,
odor learning.
Not all odor learning has to occur in the bulb. What this demonstrates is that some odor learning appears to occur in the bulb. Some classes of odor learning can occur in the bulb. But that doesn't mean that all of it has to. And it's certainly, if you're talking about sort of more complex conditional types of odor relevance. You know, if I smell, I mean, when you can teach a rat that if it smells peppermint in the presence of a red light, it should run away. It's very unlikely that that's happening in the olfactory bulb, right? Because there's not that much opportunity for the red light to converge into the olfactory bulb, unless
you have this system of reinforcement.
Yeah, yeah. Which is what this guy argues. So you have to do it with a long loop, so that now the red light is going to activate the brainstem modulatory system that will lend feedback. But then the alternative is the prefrontal cortex. And you have to ask yourself, you know, why do we have all that brain devoted to higher processing of olfactory if it doesn't do something?
Visual inputs to the prefrontal cortex.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Ultimately, the question is debated. This fellow, because he has to promote his research line, is strongly promoting the fact that associative learning for odors occurs in the main olfactory bulb, and he doesn't posit things outside.
But in terms of experimental evidence, there is experimental evidence for LTP kind of things in olfactory.
No, there's almost no. There's absolutely no evidence that I know of. Good evidence. There's one paper by out of Shipley's group that is arguing for LTP at presynaptic terminal to mitral cell under.
Oh, in
piriform cortex? I don't know. There has been so little done in olfactory cortex. So little work done in olfactory cortex. All of the emphasis has been on the bulb lately, and in the past there was really nothing much done in the olfactory system in general. So the olfactory cortex is extremely neglected. Those are the papers. That's about it, and that involves cholinergic modulation of associative versus long range connections. That's you're really talking about literally a handful of papers, and those are several years old at this point, right? No, very 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 little. I have to admit, there's almost nothing. Anyway, why did I go here? Because I actually went into the accessory olfactory bulb because I wanted to talk to you about something that we found in the frog that we're going to check in the rat that I think is really cool. And I'll finish. I'm going to finish here. I won't talk about the granule cell spine stuff, which is also really neat because it's late. You guys probably want to go, so I should stop. But anyway, we discovered looking at when we began to test this synapse from the vomeral nasal organ to the mitral cells of the accessory olfactory bulb, using the same paradigms that we used for the main olfactory bulb, whereas I showed you all that very pronounced paired pulse depression, there's actually almost no paired, there is not, there's no paired pulse depression in the accessory olfactory bulb. There's massive amounts of facilitation instead. And the cool thing about this facilitation, and I'm using that term very loosely, is that it's striking in how large it is given the low frequencies that you need to stimulate at. So normally, if you wanted to build up lots of facilitation at a neuromuscular junction, you'd stimulate it 20 pulses per second for a second or two. And then you'd maximize your facilitation at about threefold or something like that. And if you go into cortex and you find a connection between a pyramidal cell and an interneuron in a cortical slice, you'll get a twofold facilitation if you're lucky, and it'll have a time course of decay of a couple hundred milliseconds, so that you have to stimulate at fairly high frequencies before you can build it up, and as soon as you stop stimulating, it goes away. In the accessory olfactory bulb, you can get threefold. This is 2.2-fold, 2.5-fold facilitation, stimulating 3 or 4 action potentials at 5 hertz. So the next slide shows what we're talking about here in terms of a current clamp recording. That's a 5 hertz train, and there's 4 action potentials, and you can see lots of facilitation of the EPSP. And in this slide, what we're showing is the decay of that enhancement as a function of time, when you've delivered a short train like that and then tested it intervals afterwards. And it's a remarkably slow decay. The only other place that I know of that even comes close to this in terms of the time course of decay is interestingly the dentate gyrus and CA3 synapse, which is another one of those gems that's out there waiting to be looked at in more detail. The dentate gyrus to CA3 requires relatively low frequencies of firing. 5 or 10 hertz will, for a couple of seconds, will give you maximal facilitation. And the time course of that decay can last 10 seconds for the enhancement afterwards. If this was a neuromuscular junction, by this point here, we would be back to the... By that point in time there, we would be back to resting levels of facilitation. It would be all over in a couple of seconds.
This is necessary for detecting phenomenon at very low concentration.
That's our working hypothesis. You can see if you deliver stimuli to the nerve at 1 every 2 seconds, like here, you know, a single stimuli, that you have striking enhancement of the EPSP. At those those firing rates. So our belief is that this is a great system for being able to detect something at a low level. Now the price you pay may be in being able to discriminate fine differences in particular odorants, because in order to do this, what they had to throw away for one thing is the presynaptic inhibition is not present. The periglomerular cells, GABA B receptors, that just isn't happening in the accessory olfactory bulb. There's also less lateral inhibition. That was the first part of the talk.
On the main bulb.
In the main bulb, yeah. Okay, in the accessory olfactory bulb, we see no evidence for this paired pulse depression of presynaptic release from the primary afferents.
So only facilitation.
You see pure facilitation. Now there's a teensy bit, okay, but it's teensy. Yeah, it's almost a purely facilitating system. So.
But I don't understand, so why not building just a mute synapse?
Excuse me, why not?
Facilitation.
Why not?
Why not just having a linear strong synapse to begin with? You're saying it makes sense in order to recognize the low concentration. Okay, so just have a stronger synapse. Why have this facilitation?
So this is good for low concentrations, which persists.
That's, I think, the secret there. See, Misha's, I think Misha's got it right there. That's exactly
what it is. Because I perceive from low, which temporal.
That's right.
So you, that's
fine.
What's really low?
Yeah, it may have that, and if I'm trying now in my head to think about how you could use this to orient, or whether or not it would be useful for orienting, which is what these pheromonal things are often involved with. It's there is one amphibian pheromone known. It's from an Australian salamander, I think. and what it causes is aggregation of the females. No, aggregation of the males. It's a female released pheromone causes, if you put it in the water, causes males to congregate there. And so for mate, it's presumably for mate finding. Then there must be something that you want to do that would have some sort of a temporal signature to it. They would have a certain amount of time when it would hang around, not forever, but long enough that you wouldn't miss it. Very, very low rate. You mean in the mitral cells? In the presynaptic afferents.
Right.
Unlike the main olfactory bulb, where there is a significant rate of spontaneous firing, it appears that in the accessory olfactory, in the vomeronasal nasal organ, there is not. We don't see evidence here in the mitral cells themselves. We don't see spontaneous EPSCs when we're recording from them, even though the nose is there and intact. We don't see. In the nose attached to the brain. Okay, in that in vitro preparation. And when we put a blocker on of the glutamate receptors, we don't see a drop in the membrane potential of these cells. Whereas in the mitral cells, you do see a little drop. And particularly in the periglomerular cells, where I said they have a very high input impedance, and so you can see lots of you can see the every PSP, every time a sensory cell fires, you see a spontaneous event in those periglomerular cells. That tells you what the rate of sort of spontaneous inputs in the main olfactory bulb. It's relatively high, sort of around 1 spike per second or so.
In the main.
Let's see, one spike. About one spike actually every 10 seconds, I think, is the spontaneous firing rate. But you have thousands, remember, going into any glomerulus. And every periglomerular cell is hooked up to hundreds of these presynaptic terminals. So it works out to around one PSP spontaneously per second. Here we see no evidence for that. And as it turns out, when you take, so in mammals, when you dissociate the receptor cells from the accessory olfactory, from the vomeronasal nasal organ, and throw them out in the dish as isolated cells, and then challenge them with an odorant, an appropriate stimulator of them. It's not really an odorant. You challenge them with the second messenger. It turns out if you hit them with ATP, you can turn them on. They fire at very low firing rates. This just independent of anything that we found is that compared to the main olfactory bulb, the actual vomeronasal receptor cells don't fire at rates nearly as high as the receptors from the main olfactory bulb when you challenge them in the same way, when you depolarize them with the same kind of second messenger activating elements. So it's very possible that they aren't just inherently set up to fire at lower rates with a much sparser coat. I don't have all the answers by any stretch, but there's something very intriguing about and dramatic about the differences between the two odor processing regions in the front end of the brain, vis-a-vis the short-term synaptic plasticity, the activity-dependent stuff. I can stop there. I can stop there. If anyone, if at some point in the future you're interested in seeing how a calcium-activated non-specific current can be used to selectively amplify one kind of synaptic input and not another, creates a very serious nonlinearity in the input-output properties of these granule cells. Another place for creating a nonlinearity, you can call me and I'll let you know. If you're ever needing an example of how can I create a nonlinearity, how can I get a cell to just ignore synaptic inputs of this amplitude, but then become strongly activated by ones that are just a little bit larger, then I'll tell you. I can tell you about that. But I won't do it now because it's definitely time to go.